Welcome to Showdown. I'm Mark Kaysen. And we have probably, if everything works out right, we have a really outstanding person from Washington University who has been on the air here before, and he is the managing editor of something called the Baldwin Review. He is a world-renowned expert dealing with James Baldwin, and so we'll definitely get to him if that all works out, and we'll see. And then I have three students who will join us if they get it all together. They have the links, but I didn't send the links until late. Oh, there we go. There we go. Wonderful. Okay. Bring them in. So, Justin, how are you?
I'm good. Mark, how are you?
I am terrific. Now, I am guessing that you used that link that I just sent to you minutes ago. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Because I thought to myself, I wonder if you have the old link, but who knows where it is in the email. So, I'm glad it worked, and so we're good on that. And
Yeah. And
we might have three students that may join us. If they do, they do, and we'll see.
Okay.
But let me say that it is so nice that we have access to the Baldwin Review, which you are what? The managing editor?
Yes. So I'm one of the three founding editors.
Okay.
And I'm the current managing editor.
Okay.
It's not executive editor only because we're trying really hard to be collegial about it. It's a team effort and all of that.
I gotcha. Okay. Well, let's say this, and I'll say my thing, and then you can say yours. But you know, this is a journal, a scholarly journal that you work on, or founded actually at 10 years ago. And all of this is tied in with Washington University. And in fact, the work that you've done with James Baldwin is just phenomenal. And you know, I'm sure you know that, but it's nice to hear it, I guess. But it's incredible work. There are 10 years worth of this online, available to anybody that just wants to come in and access any of the articles going back 10 years about James Baldwin. Now, I have to tell you, I talked to a friend of mine the other day who is very well educated. He attended the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He's a top journalist in town. He's done great work in every area. He's got 15 Emmy Awards in the St. Louis market. So that in itself is incredible.
Yep.
And he didn't know who James Baldwin was. I mean, I almost fell over. Now, the fact that he supports Donald Trump, I told him that's probably his difficulty. They're sucking information out of his brain. But the thing is that, you know, historical memory is amazingly short. And you know, I've learned that over many years. You can go around and ask who Walter Cronkite is and they'll look at you, you know, cross-eyed.
Yeah.
Which is amazing, impossible, but true. And so the fact that maybe some people haven't heard of James Baldwin, okay, that's possible, but to me it's not possible, but I understand that it's like that. But he was a tremendous activist as a writer in the civil rights movement. And there is, and I'm sure you know this better than I, and that is there is a documentary from 2016 using the voice of Samuel L. Jackson, And it's the words of James Baldwin, who died in 1987, of course. So, you know, but this documentary, which is called I Am Not Your Negro, is just outstanding. And I've showed it to all my kids. You know, these are high school kids, and they're all black. And the thing about it is, we've talked about, number one, the use of the word Negro, which, of course, was used by everybody at that time, including Martin Luther King.
Sure.
And then we also asked the question, what does he mean? I am not your Negro, okay? And of course, James Baldwin was very assertive, to say the least. And he was, you know, telling white people, you know, you don't run me.
For sure.
Yeah. And in addition to all of that, it's just so great to read his material, because he was brilliant. And he was on the air in that documentary at the beginning, talking to Dick Cavett, who naturally no one would know who he is, although he is still alive, but and I've seen him around, but I know no one would know him, although he was a terrific interviewer, of course. And he interviewed James Baldwin at the beginning of this documentary and asked the question, do you still think that race relationships, that the future for it all, that it's hopeless? And with a smile on his face, which Cavett acknowledged, he did explain that it was hopeless. And there we are. But I also have to tell you that I worked for 25 years in black radio here in town with one of the top black announcers, broadcasters in St. Louis, a man named Onion Horton.
Okay.
And Onion said the same thing. He always said it was hopeless. And in saying that it was hopeless, he also sort of indicated the same thing that Baldwin had done, which is never stop trying, but it's hopeless. You know, and here we are in 2024, and you know, I you're younger than I am, but here's the thing. You know, you go back into the 60s, and you know, you've got us, these young kids who wanted to hop on buses to go south to register black voters, the Freedom Riders, and some died. You know, Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. We know their names. And the fact is that you, as my partner used to say, you couldn't draw better human beings than those young people in the 60s who were working for the civil rights movement. If you tried, they were the best kids. So here's the question after all of that.
Sure.
How in the heck could we be here in 2024 with the mess that we've got? How's that possible?
Well,
tough one.
If I knew all of those answers, I think I would be a politician of sorts. Right?
There you go.
But I mean, I think in a lot of ways you've where you started is a good example of how we've ended up here. And by that I mean to say, part of the problem that we experience in our politics and in our public culture is a lack of historical memory. Folks just don't understand the arc of how we get here, right? And how what has depended on our relationship to each other, whether that's a good relationship or a bad relationship, right? And James Baldwin was a fierce advocate of telling the truth, right? It was always a issue of you can't move on unless you face the reality before you and all that led up to that. And so much of American politics today seems to be about trying to ignore that ugly reality. Right? Especially anything that happened in the past. There's a historical amnesia that's really damaging to any good faith efforts to move forward. And I will say, I mean, not, I hope it doesn't come off as a shameless plug, but that's one of the things that James Baldwin Review is about. That's what we're trying to do. That's what we sort of exist for, is to fill in some of those gaps by making it freely available. As you mentioned, it's not a subscription journal. It's free all around the world. Anybody that can access the internet can access it. And that helps fill out some of those gaps, right? It's important that James Baldwin was an amazingly talented writer. He's also on the same, on the other hand, he's also not an easy read. It takes an investment. It takes time. And that time might be because of his prose style, and it might also be because he's challenging the reader. You have to be willing to pay a price for change in the world. The other thing you sort of touched on is, James Baldwin is remembered as a writer when he's remembered, and right, people that do know him.
Yep.
But he also was torn in the particular moment he lived in, right? He was famous. I mean, famous all around the world, yep, at a time when fame was very different than it is today, right? He's on the cover of Time and Life magazine on the heels of a book coming out in 1963, arguably his most famous book, The Fire Next Time, which is an essay collection, right? So, and this was a really radical challenge to race consciousness. And Baldwin is internationally famous. But at the same time, in this moment, an African-American writer is sort of pigeonholed to only be writing about quote-unquote Black problems and Black people. And so Baldwin feels really torn because he wants to just be a writer. And this is a common thing in African-American literary studies, is whether or not one is a great writer or whether or not one is a great Black writer or a great African-American writer or even an African writer or so on and so forth, right? And so Baldwin's really torn. And at the same time, literally on the streets, there are horrific things happening and also really beautiful things happening with people like the Freedom Riders trying to make change happen. And Baldwin is personally invested in that. He is literally boots on the ground trying to make some of these things happen. He was there for the Freedom Day drives in September 7th was Freedom Day, right? It's a day to get people registered in 1963. Baldwin is there, boots on the ground, trying to make this happen. There was a really great piece that came out in New Yorker roughly a year ago. Forgive me on the exact date. They talked very much about that day for Baldwin. And one of the things that I'm super proud of, and I know everybody involved in the journal is that this year's volume, volume 10, which comes out next week on Tuesday, will be released online. We have a feature section that is all about this one particular day where James Baldwin is traveling in California, and it's in May in 1963, right? So he's in California, May 7th, 1963. May of 1963 is a really important moment for the civil rights movement, because what's happening is Birmingham. Most of the photos that you see, if you do see documentary footage of the horrific things happening, with dogs unleashed on people, fire hoses on protesters, this is from Birmingham. This is happening while Baldwin is touring California for CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. He's giving these speeches. And this one particular day, he gives three different speeches and radio interviews. And we have the archival recordings of these speeches. We've transcribed them and we've presented them in James Baldwin Review. They've never been printed before.
Wow.
So we're really, really excited. And the Baldwin estate gave us permission to do that. That was a really beautiful partnership there. And so being able to present Baldwin speaking at UC Berkeley, then giving a radio interview himself that day, he gave at least two, and we think maybe three, but we're not sure about the third. And then he gave a speech at the San Francisco Masonic Temple, all of this in one day. And so being able to present this to the world is a really important moment for the journal, because while we're trying to make things publicly available for everybody, it has to be said that we're supported by a university. We're run out of a dynamic interdisciplinary department at WashU, the Department of African and African American Studies. And So we are also a scholarly journal, right? And so part of it is being able to flesh out a fuller picture of James Baldwin, because he's remembered sometimes as a writer, sometimes as an activist, sometimes as a Black writer, sometimes as a queer writer. But all of those things together was this beautiful, complicated person, just like we're all beautiful and complicated. And so part of our mission is to be able to flesh that out, fill that out. That was a lot, Mark. Did that?
Well, no, listen.
Answering your question.
We are both talkers here. You know, we can talk. So sure. Yeah, we got some time, so that's good. You know, you mentioned the African American Studies Department at WashU, which often we call Black Studies.
Sure.
And you know, we did another one of these institutes over the summer. And they are phenomenal. We've done two of them in the last 2 years. And then like 10 years ago, we were doing them with Gerald Early, who yeah. is still around there. But, you know, Shanti is, you know, running the department now. But the bottom line to what I'm going to say here is that the things that we talk about at the university, well, one of them is this difference between what you said already, which is, are you a Black writer? Are you an African studies writer? Or, you know, what do you call yourself? And how do you really figure all this out? And does it matter if it's any different language that's used? And all of it probably matters in some ways to people who are trying to think this through. And so there's no question, and this is so sad, that our society looks at the kinds of things that we do at the university and they think, well, who cares? How do you get a job? I mean, is that upsetting?
To me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, to be really candid, yes. I've spent my entire adult life involved in the university space. And one of the things that really frustrates me is when people say, you know, what's going to happen in the real world? As if the work we do in universities isn't real. It's very real.
Right.
There's very real people doing really real work that contributes to the knowledge base of our society, right? So I do take a little bit of umbrage to it, but I'm not from you, right? But the whole dichotomy of the university as a separate space, and then there's the real world over here, it's a real false dichotomy, and it's not helpful. And I also think the vocational push it's lamentable, right? I mean, I understand where people are coming from. University is a big investment. It's an investment of time. And it's an investment of money, right? And we live in a capitalist society, an increasingly neoliberal society, where goods and services are available based on your financial means. So having a job, having a vocation is something that you can't ignore. And
right.
Not but.
That's right.
And done properly, a university education is a space to learn how to learn and learn how to think. If you can learn how to learn and you can adequately think, then whatever vocation you choose is your choice and it's up to you and you're well suited to do it, right? But if you're going to a university just for vocational training, I think you're doing yourself a disservice. I should say there are plenty of vocational training institutes and schools and tracks. No disrespect to those, but that's a different thing than the university sphere. And oftentimes, the attack on higher education just sort of lumps everything in together, and you get the most hyperbolic examples trotted out where you have university presidents who have to go before Congress to answer for things.
Yeah.
And it just, it seems a distraction at best. I'm trying to be politic.
No, you're being very nice about it because we know how difficult and really bad this is. So, no, I understand it very well. And some people do, and some people, you know, shrug it off. I remember 2 years ago at the Institute when we did it in the summer, there was a headline in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and then somebody would say, what are you doing reading the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, you know? But, you know, some people just read. But at any rate, the headline in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, you know, talked about how universities in America are considered basically superfluous. And the thing about that was, is that when I brought it into talk about at the Institute, I pointed out that the headline that announced this looked like it was the headline for somebody having been assassinated. I mean, it was the size of what you would have seen when Kennedy died, you know. Yeah. So, and this was, you know, explaining how, you know, basically the university is dying. And that's pretty sad, but also not true.
No, I mean, there are thousands of institutions of higher education in the United States alone, right? Higher education is a very vibrant sphere. It's not that it's dying, it's that it's being challenged, just like authority and expertise is challenged sort of broadly, right? And there's a certain political agenda that capitalizes on and benefits from not allowing there to be such things as authorities, right? And I mean, I'm struggling, Mark, because I don't entirely feel comfortable maligning the entire way the university system is funded, but it needs to be said that there is a distinction between public funding for the public land grant universities and the public institutions, and there are private institutions. And so often the private institution gets trucked out and used as a hyperbolic example, and then the public institutions suffer. Right?
No, so, definitely. You got it.
So a well-resourced university like Harvard or Columbia or Penn, right? There's a pattern here of the examples I'm picturing.
Sure.
Get trotted out, before Congress when there is a political point to be scored. And then the damage is done, and that damage doesn't really impact that university in the same way that it impacts a lesser funded state school that is literally financially beholden to the legislature of that state. They don't have the endowment. Their funds come from the, you know, state senate, so on and so forth. And so that's part of the weaponization of higher education, which earlier I said it's a distraction because that has very little to do oftentimes with what is literally happening in the real spaces of the university, in the real world of university life, right? So the library that holds the archive that keeps the photos so that when a academic publication, if we'll bring it back to James Baldwin, right? So James Baldwin Review wants to talk about this one day in 1963. Well, I'm able to go to the San Francisco Public Library, and I'm able to work with the librarians at Pacifica Radio Archives in order to get audio that is reel-to-reel audio, mind you.
Of course. Yeah, who's ever heard of that? But okay.
They make digital copies for me, and then I'm able to see contact sheets for photo negatives that are then converted into the images that all the world will be able to see next week when the journal goes live, right?
Right.
That's the kind of archival work that can't get done if the budgets are slashed because somebody won a political point here. And so that's why I realize my body language sort of got ahead of me, Mark. When you brought it up, I bristled about the university, right?
Right.
Because we're in this bind here, right? And the bind, though, is because we are beholden to a public. We as university figures, right? I'm a part of the institution, right? I'm part of Washington University in St. Louis. So folks at that university campus and the surrounding area, right? Greater St. Louis and Missouri have every right, every reason to say, what is it that I do that benefits the knowledge of the world? And I will say, well, hey, we're trying really hard to put together a good journal and we're giving it away for free.
Yep.
I mean, hopefully that works, but it's, that's the bind, right? Is you can't just say what we do matters because knowledge is important to be kept. You also have to work to communicate it and show that value. And I will say, I feel lucky to be in a position of dealing with James Baldwin's, the renaissance of attention to James Baldwin in the last 20 years, right? In the last 20 years, it's been easier and easier to talk about James Baldwin because he is more and more famous and popular. Arguably, certainly more than the day he died, right? His popularity ebbed and flowed during his lifetime.
Absolutely.
So on the one hand, that is professionally very satisfying. But on the other hand, if James Baldwin wasn't so powerfully relevant, the world might be a better place. Back to your earlier commentary, Mark, about race relations and whether or not there's any hope for them, right? James Baldwin would have said, there has to be hope. We can't wake up tomorrow and say there's no hope. There has to be. You have to keep fighting. You have to keep doing it, right? But we're in a spot where what James Baldwin said in 1963 stings in a way that we would hope it didn't still this many years afterwards.
Yeah. Well, I know that when I began giving this assignment to my students, which I did right away at the beginning of the semester, and it's a very, as you say, all of this is a tough read when you're a sophomore in high school. You know, imagine that. But at the same time, there are some very interesting articles that deal with, for example, James Baldwin in and his ideas about art, his ideas about film. I mean, all kinds of different things. Now, somebody might say, well, who cares? Well, you know, we've got young people at our school who I think absolutely they care. And there's a reason for them to care. And what I'm going to do right now is introduce you to two of my students. These are sophomores from Cardinal Ritter College Prep High School. And they are both sophomores. And I've got Mackenzie and Mackay. Now, I want, and actually their last name is Kirkman. They're sisters. So now here's the important thing, though, Justin. You're going to look at them and you're going to say, wait a minute, they're the same person. But obviously they're twins. Well, actually they're triplets. There's a third one who is the brother, and that's McCoy. And I can tell you right now, these are three fabulous young people who are on their way to amazing college careers. I can tell you that's coming. Yeah, so they're terrific. So before, you know, I go crazy telling you how great they are, let me just ask. So girls, can you tell me anything about having accessed the Baldwin Journal?
And girls, I'm sorry to interrupt, Mackenzie and Mackay. It's wonderful to meet you. I just want to interrupt and say you're in a safe space. I'm an identical twin myself.
Ah.
And my children are twins.
Wow. So, okay.
We're good with
we
twins.
We got a bunch of this going on, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So I'm excited to meet you guys. And
okay.
Yeah. I'm excited to meet you too. When we accessed the James Baldwin's quiz, I found one on there that talked about his sexuality or whatever, and I found it interesting. how it talked about how he was like so open about it and wanted to help other like young black males who were also gay. And yeah.
Okay.
And then the article I read called Love is the Key, and it was basically talking about how the key to like finding like friends as far as like being friends with different races and the being friends with like
the people that. Okay. Yeah. So we got some feedback, you all. So, yeah. Okay. Try it again.
Okay. As far as like being friends of being around certain people of like different races and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, yeah. And really, at the beginning, I have to tell you, Justin, there were different ways of reaching the journal. And the easiest one that I found, and I sent everybody a link, was to the JSTOR link, and that worked great. And then everybody was able to get everything off of there. So, you know, anybody listening that wants to access this, the JSTOR connection was really easy to use.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, Makai McKenzie, I will say this is some of the things that, right, to jump back, Mark and I have talked a couple of times about historical memory, right? And there's a couple different age groups going on between the four of us. And that's one of the sort of bridges, is to be able to talk about that through literature, right? And James Baldwin absolutely is writing about his sexuality in a very different political environment about sexuality than we live in today. Completely different. Right. And so being openly gay was dangerous.
Sure.
I mean,
very
literally, physically and financially and politically dangerous. Not to mention emotionally fraught. Right. For somebody to write openly about that is a real daring thing. It's a big challenge. And that's one of the reasons that he is seen as a trailblazer. And then also in terms of race relations and being able to make friends of different, you know, connections. I mean, James Baldwin is writing a good chunk of his career is during legal segregation in the United States. James Baldwin leaves the United States because he realizes that the segregated social environment is so threatening to him that he is going to do harm to himself or others because he's so frustrated with it. And it is a danger to him, so he leaves. He moves to France, right? So for him to be able to, on the one hand, say effectively, I cannot, my own real life is in danger, I'm leaving, and then write about how important it is to make friendships across those divides, I mean, that's a pretty powerful message.
Yeah, it was also very interesting when we watched all that is with the students, the documentary, that the words, the Baldwin words, which were voiced by Samuel L. Jackson, were that he didn't care about baseball. He didn't care about ice cream. He didn't care about hot dogs. He didn't care about anything having to do with the United States. And he was really glad to be rid of the United States because of some of the things that you've described. And yet, he then came to a point in his life where he felt that he had an obligation because he felt here he's off in France and he can get away with this. He doesn't have to listen to too much of this talk about black problems in America, which he was so angry about. And then on top of that, listening to the French talk about Algeria, which is another story altogether. But the point is that he said that he was just feeling that he just had walked away from something where he had to come back and do some work that he owed to his country and to other black people.
So if I may, can I ask you both a question? Like, having read that little bit of, or had that exposure to James Baldwin, does that make any of the, like, to put it real pointedly, Mackenzie, has it made it easier or harder for you to forge friendships through differences? Do you feel more empowered to do it, or do you feel more disappointed if other people aren't doing it? Or in your own, like, does that exposure help at all or no?
I feel like love, I feel like that it makes it easier for me to, like, make friends with different races and stuff, because, like, it's not just about, like, being, having, like, conflict between people because of, like, our past or history, or, like, how we feel about the past and stuff.
Okay.
Fair enough. Makai, does that resonate with you, or did you have a different takeaway?
Yeah, I feel the same thing. I feel like because, like, since, like, usually, like, people are able to, like, be in the same space with people of different races, and I feel like it's a less bit of a problem to, like, make friends with other races now. And so for me personally, I've never had an issue with that, and I feel like her article only just makes it just easier to look, see it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's all good. And this is really high level thinking for young people that are sophomores in high school. It's the start of exactly what you were talking about, Justin, which is this whole different way of learning how to think about the world and yourself and other people. And it's just, it's so essential, and it's what we do in the academic world that a lot of times people don't realize in terms of the importance. And, you know, I know it was hard for all the young people, and you can talk about this, girls, if you'd like, to read the academic language, because it's a different world of language. But it's also something that really has to do with how people think and talk at universities all over the world. So any thoughts on the language, girls? How hard was it to read?
I can tell you, I think it's hard to read.
Yeah, I agree.
I feel like some of the articles were really difficult to read, where some of the other ones were really, like, easy to read.
Okay.
It really depended on which one it was. Like, I feel like just some of them were easier to, like, understand.
Yeah, I would say definitely. That's a good point. How about you, Makai?
As I was, like, going through the articles trying to, like, pick one, I saw that, like, the words were more complex. And each one I noticed, there was, like, some really hard words in there. And I feel like that's what made it, like, more, like, harder to pick an article. And so when I picked the article that I used, I just, like, read through it, and I just tried to, like, understand it to, like, the best that I could. And I understood it. But I had to look up some of the words.
So. Sure.
Yeah. And I will say, I don't admit that I'm excited to hear that. I mean, I realized that this was an assignment, right?
Yes.
You pick something, right? But even still, right, the fact that you could look through and you could pick something, that's a good thing, right? Because so much of academic writing is a small group of people talking to each other, right? They're writing it, but they're really just back and forth. And I will say, I have an identical twin brother, and he is not at all in the same profession that I am. He's a computer programmer,
okay,
right? And he really does not He's not interested. He does not have stacks and stacks of books and all that, right? That's just not his thing, right? And so in a way, I always have, you know, sort of his view of it in my mind, maybe on my shoulder, right? So that when I'm putting things together and I'm trying to pick, I'm always like, what is the one thing I could have in this volume of the journal that somebody who never even heard about James Baldwin until yesterday, they'll be able to go through and pick something. And they'll be like, this is worthwhile. This is valuable to me. And Mark, I will say, I appreciate you bringing the four of us together, because now I get to think to myself, what's the one thing I can put in the journal? So when the high school group has to go through it, then they'll find something that they're like, yes, I can sure do this one. So it's a new audience that we can reach out to.
Yep. Okay. So if you all can hang in here for 1 second, I've got a little business that I have to do on the air to, you know, pay for what we do, and sure, and then we'll be right back. Okay. So here we are, 41 minutes into the show, and you might be thinking about dinner tonight, and if you are, you certainly ought to be thinking about Wendy's, which is in Chesterfield Valley. It's at 18,000 Chesterfield Airport Road, and they have great food. And I talk about it all the time, of course. They've got wings, which everybody seems to love. And, you know, I'm a little weird, but, you know, wings isn't my thing. But on the other hand, my thing is the baby back ribs, which they've got. And that's also fabulous at Wendy's. Now, they also have hamburgers and cheeseburgers and patty melts. I love the onions. I love onion rings, and they've got onion rings. And they've just got everything here, salad, pizza, you name it. Wendy's, great place to eat, great place to meet people, bring people. And in addition to Chesterfield Valley, they've got one now in Defiance. So you go to Defiance, Missouri, $29.99, South Highway 94. Same great food, same great people that own it. And I can tell you right now, you will love Wendy's. Now, if you're thinking about maybe getting some jewelry, you might want to go to 4506 Hampton. That's Jewels on Hampton. And they've got all cases filled with jewelry throughout their store. So much that it takes a while to really go through it all. But it's all good, and you'll love it. You'll find it very interesting. They buy and sell jewelry and coins. And on top of all of that, they design jewelry. So you can talk to them about different designs that you're interested in. And after all the time that you spend there, you know, maybe it took so long, now you look at your watch and realize it's broken. That's good, because they'll fix your watch too. They're experts when it comes to fixing watches. It is Jewels on Hampton, 4506 Hampton. You'll love Al and AJ. They're there all the time. You'll love them. Okay. Now, the St. Louis Suit Company is in Clayton, and it's at the corner of Central and Forsyth. Great clothes for men. Really nice suits, shoes, shirts, overcoats coming for the fall weather that's going to turn really cold in winter. All of this at the St. Louis Suit Company, which has been there for 30 years. They are a great place. And then on top of that, if you're getting married, they also do weddings. So you can get all this great wedding attire also at the St. Louis Suit Company. So, having said all of that, don't forget, they have got ties that are silk and beautiful and great designs and look really expensive, and they cost $5. And everybody says, $5 for a tie? What are you, crazy? But they do sell these ties for $5, and they are incredible. That is the St. Louis Suit Company in Clayton. Now, here's a new one. Because, you know, you can't just eat every minute at Wendy's. I mean, you'd like to, but sometimes there might be something else you want to eat. And the place to go or think about is Talena's. And let me say this about Talena's. My friend, Mehdi Rouhani, who is Iranian, and that's kind of interesting, Iranian, who owns an Italian restaurant and has run this Italian restaurant that is loved throughout St. Louis for 40 years. That's a long time. And I can tell you that the food that he's got there, it's Italian food for sure. I mean, everybody loves their pizza. Everybody loves all their different Italian meals. And then I've got to tell you that I happen to be a spaghetti and meatballs person. Their spaghetti and meatballs is without a question the best spaghetti and meatballs that I have ever had anywhere. And I've eaten some good places. But I will tell you, they also do catering. And I'll tell you, that they're so reliable. The food is so good all the time. Great Caesar salads. I love it. And this is a place that you can find really in essentially Creve Coeur. It's on the corner of 141 and Olive in Creve Coeur. And you'll love Talena's, and it's just, it's great food. I always, when I have Mehdi doing this advertising for us, I've always called Friday Spaghetti and Meatballs Day at Talena's. But in any event, it's a famous place in St. Louis. Great, great food, great Italian food. So they've joined us today, and really good people. Mehdi Rouhani is fabulous. If you go in there and you see Mehdi, I mean, you just got to go and say, hey, Kaysen sent me here. And by the way, how do you put up with that guy? So, yeah, all that. He's a good friend. Okay, so we're back, and we're, you know, going to finish up. And so let me ask you this, girls, because, you know, I've given you some challenging things to read in class. How challenging is it really compared to what you've dealt with in the past? I'm sort of interested in hearing it.
I feel like the most of the stuff that you give us to read is like really difficult. Like most of the stuff I might have to look up or something like that compared to the stuff that I've read in the past.
Sure. Okay. And how about you, Makai?
I was like reading chapter 17 the other day,
right?
The Reformation. Yep. And like everything in there was so difficult to like put together and try to figure out. Like it wasn't as easy as other, like as reading other things are. It was like, I don't know. It's like on a higher level.
Sure.
And yeah, it took like I had to look some stuff up because some of the words were like so difficult to read.
No question about it.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the stuff that you give us is hard to read and it takes a lot of,
Yeah. I mean, after you even read it, you got to figure it out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, are you familiar, Justin, with Eric Hoffer and his book, The True Believer?
No.
Okay. So he wrote that in the 1950s. And, you know, I got my hands on it when I was 14 years old. And I got to tell you, it's all about mass movements in the world. And I read through it. I loved it. But which is, you know, pretty weird for a 14-year-old. But I also have to tell you that I had to read it with a dictionary because I couldn't understand half of what was in there. And then I came back and read it years later. And I laughed that I even tried to read it when I was 14. So, you know, all of this is just part of, you know, growing up and expanding your knowledge. And this work with James Baldwin is so exciting to me because as difficult as it can be to understand everything going on with Baldwin, there are things that you can really access in a smart way. So it's not everything is you know, that difficult. And so you just need to work on it. And it helps you to think about the world in phenomenally different ways that in I know in both of our views, Justin, you and I, it's so valuable for young people to start this process, which takes them to the university and really changes their lives.
Yeah, and I mean, I realize the challenge of reading difficult books, but sometimes we're in a world where the challenge is to read a book.
Sure.
To literally sit down and read one book, right? Because so much of our media economy, so much of the way we experience the world is fractured, right? A little bit here, a little bit here, a little bit there. To be able to sit and focus on that one thing, right? That's a big challenge, and that's increasingly a rare skill. And I don't know, girls, if you feel the same way, Mackenzie and Makai, but it sounds to me like the class that you guys are in is a pretty dynamic class if you're both reading books and watching films, right? Because being able to present that same material or touch on the same material with two different presentation styles. Did you find that the documentary film, I Am Not Your Negro, did you find that easier because you were just watching it, or was it challenging because of the topics? I'm curious what the comparison would be.
Sure. And they didn't watch the whole thing, but.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry.
No, that's all right. But still they heard enough. What did you think about what you saw?
I found it both like easy and hard. Because some of the stuff that he was talking, that they were talking about, was talking about like the him leaving, I think, him like leaving the United States,
right,
and like going somewhere else because he was it was dangerous for him here. And yeah, I just feel like it was like both like easy and hard to understand.
Yeah. And what about you, Mackenzie?
I agree with her. I feel like it was both easy and hard to understand.
Right.
Like, compared to, like, the stuff that we read about as far as, like, in the articles, I feel like some of the stuff was, like, but I feel like it was kind of easier, actually.
Okay. And the interesting thing, too, especially with, and you know, all my friends at the university, Justin, they always talk about how they're not sure what they would do with teenagers compared to, you know, with college students. And you know, we're in, actually, in my view, the enviable position of preparing young people for what is going to happen when they get to the university. And you know, one of the things that I do with students, and I don't even think Mackenzie and Makai even know this one yet, because this has just been the beginning of the semester, but my juniors and seniors, they all know that if they come to me and ask me for a book, I will buy them books. I buy them books all the time. And you know, because as you pointed out so importantly, Justin, they don't want to read. You know, young people are not, you know, they're thinking about TikTok and, you know, all this other mess. And so when I tell the kids, you know, come to me if you want a book, I'm not going to sit here and tell you which book to get. And I'm not going to judge what you're reading. I just want you to read. And so I'll buy you a book. And I do. And they really like it. I'm not saying everybody. It hasn't grabbed everybody yet, but it's grabbing more young people who are going to show up at the university, and they need to have this skill of reading.
Yeah, I mean, all of my degrees are in literary studies of some sort, and I was telling Mark earlier, Makai and Mackenzie, before you joined us, that all of my professional life, all of my adult life, has been in the university sphere. So I'm convinced about the power of books. You don't have to convince me. Like, I'm in. I just if you guys do find yourself, if you do watch the movie, the full film, there is also an interview with that film director, Raoul Peck, in James Baldwin Review. So that's also freely available. Cool.
Yeah. No, and again, let's say the James Baldwin Review, it's online and it's easily accessible. I recommend going to the JSTOR link if you're not familiar with some of how to access things, but that one was really easy, and you can read anything in there. It's all free. It's all available, and it really, just the review itself is a teaching opportunity for anybody that opens it and online and tries to figure out what's going on in there. It's really very good. I really love it. And you know, obviously I'm using it with my students, Justin, and I know that it's a challenge. But the other thing is, too, is that it is currently September. And, you know, what happens, which makes us all crazy, is you get to February and everybody says it's Black History Month and everybody wants to quickly do some Black history in February. And as far as I'm concerned, forget that. I mean, let's do it all the time because there's no reason not to. So we do.
I will share. I said I had twins, and they're in eighth grade now. And every February rolls around and they're like, "Dad, what? Every month is Black History Month at our house." And I'm like, "Well, you know, like, you guys have an extra leg up in school." And I agree with you, Mark, that it's, I mean, why? The way I would put it is, Black history is American history.
Yep. Totally.
The fact that it's relegated to one thing is, I mean, it's shameful that there was a time when they had to advocate to even make that happen. To even have one month, right? With, yeah, Black history is American history. It's world history. It just.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you say shameful, let's not forget that here we are in 2024, and I hate to say it, pick up the Post-Dispatch today, and it's talking about the kinds of things that they're trying to do in school districts around Missouri having to do with eliminating Black literature, eliminating Black history, and frankly, even today there was an article about how they're trying to allow hate language, hate literature into the schools. Where does that come from? Yeah, no answer to that one, I can tell you.
The answer is the same, that we're back to a weaponization of the pursuit of knowledge, right? If we can make telling the truth and spreading knowledge something that is forbidden and not allowed, then we lose. We open the door to chaos. That's it, right? That's the fight, is to say these things matter. We need to preserve this stuff, and we need to be able to have differences of perspectives, right? And I mean, if only because we've been talking about James Baldwin this whole time, I mean, he has this really amazing quote that I use often, right? But it's beautiful and it really resonates, right? And so this is from an interview in 1963, right when Baldwin's super internationally famous, right? He has this interview and he says, quote, "You think your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world, but then you read." It was Dostoevsky and Dickens who taught me that the things that tormented me the most were the very things that connected me with all the people who were alive or who ever had been alive.
Yep.
And I mean, that connection that happens from different time periods, different sexualities, different races, right? That exposure to different ways of being in the world is what literary studies is all about. It's what the exposure is all about.
And we're at the end here. I'm sorry. Right. Yeah. But let me say, Justin Joyce from the James Baldwin Review, it's online, and we'll talk about it, make it available, more information on it. And thank you, Mackenzie and Mackay, for being here this evening with us. And let me say that again, for Jules on Hampton, for Wendy's, for Talena's, and the St. Louis Suit Company, we thank you all for being here tonight, and we'll see you all again. This is Showdown. I'm Mark Kaysen. Good night.